and a budgetary reallocation towards sewer repair in Valgast, which I thought was a nice touch. The enemy was anticipating my concerns. Throughout the meeting, Xander said nothing. He lounged in his chair, looking more and more bored and long-suffering.
"There is one more item,"
Montfort said as the session drew to a close.
"As Councillor Trefect brought this to our attention, I will ask her to elaborate."
"Thank you, Senior Councillor,"
said Mariana Trefect. She was Xander's age, and with him was the youngest councillor present. She did not look bored, though. She looked hungry.
"This is, Lord Governor, an embarrassing admission for me, and something that I am ashamed that we are only detecting now. We have unearthed evidence of important black market activity in the agri sector of Rosala."
"Oh," I said, doing my best to feign surprised interest. "How bad is the problem?"
"We are still attempting to determine that, but I am confident we will uproot it very soon."
"I'm glad to hear it. Please keep the council informed of your progress." I stole a glance at Montfort.
"Aren't you the clever one?"
I wondered if this was just an attempt to head off my own investigations before they were properly started, or if it was a warning too.
"Are you telling me how much you know? I accept the challenge. I will defeat you."
We adjourned. The councillors filed out, and Xander rose lazily from his throne and walked across the floor to the chamber to me.
"I will leave you to your reunion,"
was Montfort's parting shot.
"Father," Xander said, "it is good to see you."
"And you." There was a moment of silence. Then Xander grinned.
"Well," he said, "aren't we being the awkward pair?"
"It is hard to know what to say after so long," I admitted. He shrugged.
"We don't have to say anything if it doesn't suit us. We can't pretend we actually know anything about each other."
The suggestion was not unfriendly. He seemed simply happy to go along with whatever I preferred. "We may be strangers," I said, "but we're also blood. That means something. And I hope we won't be strangers."
"That sounds fine, Father,"
he said, smiling with all the force of feeling, as if I'd said that I preferred one vintage of Amasek over another. "I'm glad you think so," I said, "since we will be seeing a lot of each other. We have a lot of Hark word ahead of us."
"We do?"
I was not prepared for the question, and more particularly the way it was asked. It was an expression of pure guileless confusion and dismay. For the moment, at least, it had the effect of convincing me that unless Xander was an extraordinary actor, he had no knowledge at all of what other members of the council had their hands in. But my overwhelming emotion was a sinking disappointment.
"We do?"
With those two words and a frown, he expressed bafflement that anything at all needed to be done, and horror that he might be expected to exert himself. I had wondered why Montfort had not found a way to have the representative of the Strocks removed from the council. I had my answer.
"Yes,"
I said, unable to conceal my disgust. "Great tasks lie ahead of us."
"Oh."
He paused, as if casting about for a better answer, some reason why he could be excused from the work. Then he shrugged. Perhaps he'd resigned himself to the inevitable. Or perhaps he had decided to live in the moment. I wasn't demanding effort from him just yet, so the problem could be ignored for the present. Then he changed the subject.
"Have you seen Katrin yet?"
"No." I was worried that encounter might be much more painful than meeting Xander. I did not have the emotional energy to see both my children on the same day as my return to Solus. "I plan to call on her tomorrow," I said.
"I know she'll be pleased you're back,"
said Xander, mouthing a meaningless platitude. "That would be nice," I said quietly.
"Well," he smiled again. "Well, I should be off then. Until next time, Father."
He turned and strode off before I could answer, fleeing to the promise of entertainment. I watched him go. I reminded myself that he was my son and that he was worth saving. Pure indolence is better than corruption, at least. Hang on to that. I stayed in the chamber a few more minutes, thinking about the work ahead. Purging the council seemed like the easiest of my labours. When I finally left, Adriana Weiss was waiting for me near the staircase. I was pathetically grateful to see her. She raised a sardonic eyebrow.
"So,
she said. Drinks at the Great House tonight?
Absolutely. Three of us gathered in Malvale that evening. We met in the librarium. It was at the end of the East Wing, on the ground floor. Its collection was a large one, the shelves of volumes reaching from the floor to the ceiling. The spines of the tomes were still dusty, untouched for decades. But supervised by Karoff, the serfs have made the great room usable again. I sat with two old friends, looking down the South Prospect. We were comfortable in heavy armchairs, arranged in a half circle. The librarium was warm, the Amasek excellent, and we watched the night rains of early winter wash down the windows. Just visible through the clouds was the dull yellow glow of the nitrogen atmosphere of Luctus, Solus's huge moon. I relaxed for the first time that day. I don't think I'd felt this much at ease since before Clostrum.
"Your path is going to be a hard one," said Cardinal Calvin Rivas.
"It will be," Vice said before I could answer, "but we need you." "And I will need all the help you can give," I told them.
"You have it," said Rivas, "all of it."
Vice, Rivas and I had grown up together. Their destinies had been clearly defined for them from birth, much more than mine had been, and both had embraced their duties with fervour. Vice, the firstborn of her house, had led it with honour since she'd inherited its leadership. Rivas, also the firstborn of his family, had followed his house's tradition into the ecclesiarchy. I trusted both of them, because I knew them, and no length of separation could change that. Despite the years that had passed since I'd seen them, we settled back into each other's company as if we'd only been apart a few days. Vice had startlingly large eyes. They looked upon the world with a shrewd, knowing judgment. Like Montfort, she had no illusions. Unlike Montfort, she did not use that as an excuse to indulge her worse instincts. The one thing she did indulge in was a gaudiness of attire. Her long black hair, which was just beginning to grey, was held up in an elaborate headdress, whose intertwining of gold and crimson complemented the black and scarlet of her high-coloured dress. The long feathers of the petarca bird reached out from the headdress, waving gently whenever Vice moved her head. Her theatricality was ironic, as if ostentation were symbolic of all the temptations she stood against, and was a visible rebuke to the Montforts, who were her family's enemies as much as they were mine. The Montfort clan was a fetid swamp. The House of Vice was a bulwark against corruption. The family had long been rivals of the Montforts for power. When the Strocks had risen to supremacy, the House of Vice had welcomed our assumption of power, backing us unswervingly ever since. I had, over the years, encountered ecclesiarchs who were paragons of faith, and others who were embarrassments, men who had let their souls drown in a sea of political calculation. Rivas was one of the former, though he also knew better than to hold himself aloof from politics. He was not happy about the grubby realities of power. He accepted them, though. He never turned away from what was necessary, always acting to serve the imperial creed. He was tall, always leaning forward slightly, as if perpetually in a state of concerned interest. If Vice responded to the world with wary amusement, Rivas was melancholic.
"How have things gone with your children?" Rivas asked.
I stared into my goblet, searching for the answer.
"You have seen them?"
"Not Katrin. Not yet. Maybe tomorrow."
"Xander was at council," Vice told the Cardinal.
"He was civil," I said.
"Better than the alternative."
Vice reached for the bottle on the low table before us.
"What did you think of your first meeting with the council?" she asked.
"That you're my only ally there," I said, thinking about the closed, wary faces.
"Am I right in that? Are things that bad?"
She nodded.
"I fought Montfort, and I'll keep fighting her, but she's had the whip hand until now. There was never a chance of toppling her, not with her being senior counsellor, and she's made sure the others have every reason to support her."
She raised a cautioning finger.
"She's dangerous, Mason. Very dangerous. I cannot emphasise that too strongly."
"I appreciate the warning. She'll find that I'm dangerous too."
"You'll have to be."
I forced myself to ask the next question. It was best to know the worst immediately.
"Is Xander one of her creatures too?"
"No, I don't think so. He..." She stopped.
What was your impression?
I grimaced.
That he was too lazy to undertake the work of corruption. That is my sense, too. He's wealthy enough to entertain himself as he likes. So why would he lift a finger to do more? I said, depressed. Indolence was sad cause for innocence.
Again, better than the alternative, Vice said softly.
Montfort is keeping him at arm's length from everything, and he's happy with his lot. You might be able to change that. He's still your son.
I find it difficult to believe the Strock blood is that attenuated. It isn't in his sister.
That's true, said Rivas. She's doing well.
So I hear, I said. Katrin was a history inductor at the Schola Progenium of the Valgar Sector of Solus. I was as proud of her as I was disappointed in Zalda.
Why haven't you seen her yet? Rivas pushed.
The last time I heard from her was when Aliana died. She made it clear that she did not wish to speak again. That was a long time ago.
Only it never feels like it, does it? Vice asked.
Her wife had died in a lifter crash a few years after I lost Eliana.
No, it doesn't.
How are you doing being back? Said Rivas.
I sighed.
I'd hoped that the fact that I have no memories of living in Malvale with her might make things a bit easier. It doesn't. This is hard.
The Emperor will guide you, Rivas promised.
I will need him to. I bade them good night an hour later. When I shut the door, I was alone in Malvale for the first time. In the sudden silence, I braced myself for an assault by the memories of Clostrum. The momentum of the day had served me well, but I had learned to dread nights. I expected sleep to be fleeting and bad. I knew that once I was alone, the cries of dying soldiers would rise in my mind. And as I turned from the door and began to mount the stairs, the dead called to me. The images of Clostrum, on the tide of monsters and blood, rushed forward. Only they did not force me to stop walking. Malvale did not vanish from my perception. I did not begin to drown in the clamorous echoes of my defeat. The memories were present, but they did not have the same power as before, because they were not alone. They were accompanied by other losses. Malvale's silence pulsed with all the losses of my life, and it was the older grief of Eliana's death that was the greatest of all. It enveloped me. Every second I passed in this house was a second that I should have had with Eliana, and never would. We had been robbed, and I didn't know why. I did not know how she had fallen. By the time I reached the top of the stairs, the silence of the house seemed different. It was not truly a form of quiet. It was a white noise, all of my losses roaring at me at once. This wasn't silence. It was a wall in the air, drawing around me, tightening until I couldn't breathe. I started down the hall, and vertigo hit. I had not experienced it since the day I showed Malvale to the children, but I recognized the sensation at once. The floor turned into thin ice, and threatened to turn into thin air. I staggered, my body instinctively searching for solid ground. There was none to be had. I weaved back and forth across the hall, clutching my head. "Stop it!" I told myself, hoping the sound of my words would beat back the roaring silence. "Stop it!" I shouted, barking with the voice of command. But my psyche disobeyed, and the dizziness grew worse. I was about to plunge through the floors of the house and down to the core of Solus. Everything was insubstantial, only losses and grief were real. I stopped walking. I leaned against a wall and closed my eyes. "Enough," I said, "enough." I kept repeating the word until I could focus on the sound, the real sound that I was making. The white noise receded, and the floor became solid enough to hold my weight. I made my way unsteadily towards the door leading to my bedchamber. I was still dizzy, and the choir of loss called at the edges of my mind. I took deep, regular breaths, trying to slow the irregular beating of my heart. One thing I was not experiencing was surprise. I had expected something like this. "You knew this first night would be difficult. Tomorrow night will be too, and the night after that. This is part of your battle. This is part of your penance." "The Emperor protects," I prayed quietly, clawing back my strength. "The Emperor sustains." I climbed the last flight of stairs without stumbling and arrived at my quarters. I fell into bed, feeling a small degree of triumph at having fought through the vertigo and the memories. The memories were not defeated, though. They were waiting for my defences to lower again. I craved sleep, and I feared it. I took deep breaths again, listening to that sound, grasping hard to that rhythm as though it could drown out all other noises that crowded around my soul. I listened to my breathing so I would not hear the ghosts. Then I did sleep. I fell asleep. I fell down into a nightmare, and it was a nightmare of falling. Eliana falling. I saw her leap from the tower, and in this vision, she was not alone. She held Katrin and Xander by the hand. Katrin and Xander as children, small children who would never be adults because their mother had seized them and pulled them shrieking from the parapet. They dropped with her, and they were screaming. Their three faces filled my sleeping sight. Eliana was expressionless. She fell without sound, her lips tight, her eyes dead of feeling and staring at the onrushing ground. Katrin and Xander howled, their features distorted with terror and betrayal. The dream was the most vivid I'd ever had. I felt the rush of the wind as my perspective plummeted with my family. The screams of the children pierced my ears. I saw the billowing of their clothes and the terrible vertical wind of their fall. Even as I felt myself trying to scream too, but only capable of silent horror, I knew I was dreaming. A tiny part of me understood that this was not real, and that the horror would end before my wife and children hit the stones in the base of the tower. This was the nature of nightmares. It was the way they kept from driving us mad. The crunch of impact jolted me awake, and now I could scream. Chapter 4. I did not sleep for the rest of the night. I sat in front of the window, waiting for day, pursued by my predatory, traitorous mind. The nightmare hung over me, a malevolent undertow pulling my thoughts back again and again to the images of my screaming children and to the sickening crunch of shattering bodies. The dream was as vivid as a memory, as disturbing as truth. When I tried to get away from it, the dark gravity of Klostrum pulled me in. The night was long. I prayed. But though I spoke the words aloud, I could not focus on them. When at last the light began to grey and I could see the rain streaking the window, I sagged with relief. I could almost have gone back to sleep, protected by the comfort of daylight. I resisted the temptation. I had duties. I also had pride. I would not be defeated by my weaker self. Night was when I would have time to sleep. I would have to learn again to do so. I dressed. And when I descended from my tower, I heard the sounds of serfs entering Malvale and beginning the work of the day. I lingered on the second floor, giving the kitchen staff time to prepare my meal. I explored the other rooms in this wing. Some of them were completely empty, the floors bare, the walls clear of decoration. I guessed that what Lionel had done to these had meant a purge was the only way of making them usable again. There were a couple of bedchambers close to the central staircase that were still furnished. I paused for a while in each. They felt painfully vacant. Karov found me in the room closest to the stairs. Its bed, chairs and tapestries were all dark, though it felt warm rather than gloomy.
"Will you be eating, Lord Governor?"
Karov asked. "Yes," I said absently. Then with firmness of purpose, "This room should be used. Malvale should be used."
"My lord?"
Karov said, puzzled. "Good work has been done here," I said. "Let us do a bit more. I would like you to have this and the next room down made ready to be occupied."
"Of course. May I ask what visitors we should expect?"
"Over time, we should expect many, I hope, but not in these rooms. I would like them to be prepared for my children." Karov regarded me steadily.
"They are going to take up residence in Malvale?"
"I'm going to invite them to do that, yes."
"I see."
He couldn't quite prevent the slight frown of worry that creased his brow. I put a hand on his shoulder. "I know exactly what I'm saying," I said. "They might not accept right away, or at all, but we shall go forward in the confidence that they will. This is the house of the Strocks, after all. It must be able to house the entire family." Such as it was. Neither Katrin nor Xander had children. There were other relations, other branches of the Strocks, scattered around Solus. If my line ended, another would take its place, as I had, after Lionel died without issue.
"I will see that it is done, Lord Governor," Karoff said.
"Thank you." It was up to me then to see that Karoff and the serfs' efforts would not be in vain. I had come to Solus with the hope of doing more than restoring its exports to their proper level. I wasn't sure if I hoped to heal myself. I didn't know if that was possible. But I had some thoughts of legacy, and I missed my family. I missed what it had been. I wanted to be able to hold on to what was left. I started down the stairs, Karoff a step behind me.
"Did you sleep well, my lord?" he asked.
He spoke with such genuine concern that I answered honestly. "It was a broken night."
"I expect there will be some adjustment necessary."
He sounded like he needed reassurance.
"You will not have had the luxury of such space in a long time."
"Quite so. Quite so." I wanted him to be right, too. I had Belzec leave me at the Schola Progenium. The stern complex was about a mile west of the square of the Emperor's Bounty. The Oblivis flowed around three of its sides, like a moat, isolating the Schola from a city that was failing to live up to the principles instilled inside the Institute's walls. Round towers stood at each of the building's four corners. It was square, hulking, a brutally solid fortress of discipline. Its rockcrete walls were not dark with stain, they were black to start with. There was nothing welcoming about the Schola Progenium, and that was as it should be. It took in the orphans of officers and nobles, children who had lost those on whom they depended for protection, and it changed them from the vulnerable into the strong. It turned them into shock troops and commissars and officers. It made them into the unbreakable spine of the Astra Militarum. A tall circular counter of black marble greeted me like a turret in the entrance hall. The trooper seated at it was, like Belzec, a veteran who had left most of his body behind on the battlefield. Multi-jointed tool arms extended from his shoulders, and one of his eyes was bionic, scanning me with a dull red glow. He grinned when he recognized me, and would have risen if he'd still had legs.
"Colonel!" he exclaimed, then corrected himself. "Lord Governor, I mean, I crave your pardon, I..."
"That's quite all right, trooper. I'm not used to the change in rank myself yet." He bowed his head in thanks.
"It's an honour, my lord. I served under you on Epsilon Phoros."
"Then we shared in a great victory."
"We did, my lord, we did."
"I've come to see Instructor Katrin Stock." The trooper looked startled, as if he'd only now understood the connection of the name.
"Of course, my lord."
He consulted a data slate.
"Her current indoctrination lecture will be ending shortly. Shall I send for her?"
"No, thank you. I'll go to her."
"Yes, my lord."
He turned to the servo skull hovering over the desk.
"History Strock," he said.
The skull chattered, and a ribbon of punched runic code emerged from its jaw. The trooper tore it off. Next to the counter was a servitor in a slumped passive state. The trooper fed the code ribbon into a receptor at the back of the servitor's head, and it jerked to life. It turned away from the counter, running on motorized treads, and I followed. The servitor led me through the Schola Progenium's maze of corridors. We passed numerous lecture amphitheatres, doorways to drill courtyards, and dormitoria. At length, it stopped by the entrance to a fourth-floor amphitheatre. During our journey there, I grew more and more uncertain. This was going to be a more difficult meeting than the one with Zalda. He and I had simply become strangers to one another. Katrin had broken her connections with me. I revised and discarded the things I might say to her a dozen times over. Each one was inadequate. We'd been too long apart, and the gulf was too wide. I looked through the doorway. I was at the bottom of the amphitheatre, looking up at the curving rows of pews where students sat at rigid attention. Before them, Katrin paced as she lectured.
"What, then, does the Age of Redemption teach us?" she said. "It teaches us that the will of the Emperor will ultimately triumph over every form of apostasy. It teaches us that redemption is possible, but it also shows us the path to redemption. There can only be redemption through fire, through blood,
and through the purging of the heretic and the traitor. It teaches us that mercy is worse than a weakness. It is a crime against the emperor. If mercy had been extended to a single heretic, that would have been an invitation to another rain of blood. Those who extend mercy reveal the uncertainty of their faith. On the battlefield, uncertainty means death. It means defeat. It means dishonour. If, after what we have learnt today, there is one among you who believes in the quality of mercy, then know that you will receive none from me. Her hair was the same light brown as her mother's, and she wore it shaved close to her skull. The gaze she turned on her students was forbidding. In her black uniform, her boots thudding against the floor with the steady rhythm of an execution's drumbeat, she was the embodiment of pitilessness. Her posture was unnaturally straight, held that way by the iron brace on her spine. Its collar went around her throat, adding still more to her air of absolute authority. I could see the pride she took in the work she was doing. I also knew this was not the destiny she'd initially chosen for herself. Despite our estrangement, she was the one who had once been going to follow my steps into the Soulless Night March. When Leonel died and the inheritance of the governorship came to my branch of the House of Strock, my children became automatically exempt from the military tithe, as part of the mechanism designed to ensure a continuity of role on the planet. The exemption, however, did not mean they could not volunteer. There had never been any chance that Xander would seek to serve. Katrin, on the other hand, enlisted as soon as she came of age. And then, during training, she broke her back. The injury was too severe for her to continue. The bionics necessary to make her viable in combat would be wasted on someone with no battlefield experience. Katrin could not serve on the front lines, so she had turned her energies into forging the officers who would. As I watched her, I was able to put aside some of my pain and indulge in pride. The lecture ended, and the students filed out through the upper exits. Katrin moved to a lectern and gathered her notes. "Hello, Father," she said without looking up. I stepped into the amphitheatre. I hadn't realised she'd seen me. "Hello, Katrin." She walked towards me, stopping at a formal distance. "I heard about the battle for Clostrum," she said. "I'm glad you survived." The words were a pat greeting. They did not sound genuine, and I could see the judgment in her eyes. It was that judgment that I'd been dreading, because it mirrored my own self-condemnation. She resented me since Eliana's death, and I wondered if the reasons for her anger had changed since then. Did she resent me for having left, or for having returned? Perhaps she wasn't sure herself. "Tell me," she went on, "are you grateful for having lived when so many of your troops died?" There was nothing pat about that question. The niceties were over, and I had just heard what she thought about mercy. "I'm grateful that I can still serve," I said. "Beyond that, I'm not sure." I offered her complete honesty, if she was willing to accept it. She gave me a curt nod. "We must serve the Emperor however we can, even if it is not in the manner of our first choosing." She started walking again, and we left the theatre. "Have you seen Xander?" she asked. "I have. How is he?" "You don't know?" She shook her head. "We do not speak much." "Why is that?" She looked at me as if I were mocking her. I was not. I no longer wanted things unsaid. Our family had lost too much already, and much of what we had lost was time. "If you have fallen out," I said, "I would like to know why, precisely." "All right. I don't speak to him because I don't know what has happened to his sense of honour, or shame, for that matter." "He seems to have misplaced them both," I agreed. "I intend to help him find his honour again, at least. I don't think he'll be interested in your help." "He won't have a choice. I will not permit the council to continue as it has been. That is the mission I've been given on Solus. That is how I am to serve the Emperor." "I thought you were to serve as Lord Governor." She was openly contemptuous. I saw myself through her eyes. I was a disgraced commander, scuttling away from the battlefield to slip into the privileges afforded him by the lucky chance of his birth. I could not blame her. I kept seeing the same thing in the mirror. "The governorship is a means to an end," I said. "The council is corrupt. I've been commanded to be the cleansing fire. I'm going to make Solus worthy of what you are teaching here." "I hope you will," she said. She sounded less hostile. I felt that she wanted to believe me. We parted outside her study. "I'd like to see you again," I said. "I would like us not to be strangers." She hesitated, then nodded her acquiescence. I thanked her and turned to go. I'd taken a few steps when she said, "Do you miss her?" I turned back. Do I miss her? I tried to find the words to answer, but everything I could think of to say was hopelessly trite and inadequate to the scale of Eliana's absence in my life. My silence was the answer Katrin sought. She nodded again, but more gently. We shared a moment of loss. The distance between us diminished. I thought I saw behind her wall of discipline, and at the same time, I felt I understood Xander better too. In very different ways, they had both retreated, whether they knew it or not. He into indolence, she behind the walls of the Schola Progenium. They were where they believed they would not be hurt again. Who was I to try to lure them out from behind their shields? Was I doing any better? Maybe. I think I am trying, and I think that is necessary. I left, not saying anything about Marvale. There would be time, a better time, to extend the invitation. But I left the Schola with more hope than when I had entered. I believed we could be a family and make the House of Strock as strong as it could be, as strong as Solas needed it to be. I smiled to the trooper at the entrance when I passed him again. The smile came easily. I could not remember the last time that had been true.
Rosala! They said they discovered corruption in Rosala!
Ernst Tavark, enforcer of the Adeptus Arbites, began to laugh. Soon he was roaring, pounding a hammer-like fist against the scarred surface of his desk. We were in his office, high in the thin tower that rose from the centre of the barracks of the Arbites in the southwest sector of Valgast. The windows were grimy, the view of the city smeared. I could just make out the silhouettes of the cathedral and the council hall. I had come here to prepare my opening salvo against Montfort and her allies. It was almost a minute before Stavark got himself under control.
"I'm sorry, Lord Governor," he said, wiping tears from his broad face. His features were even more scarred than his desk.
I waved his apologies away and leaned back in the chair facing him. "If the joke is a good one, I want to share in it, or have I been made its butt?"
"I'm afraid you have been, but I wouldn't worry. I don't think too many people outside this building and Rosala itself would appreciate the humour."
"Which is what?"
"Discovering a black market in Rosala would be like announcing that winter is damp."
"And this is common knowledge?"
"Not exactly. In Rosala, it's an open secret. Beyond its borders," he shrugged. "In general, I would say that if you know, then you're involved."
That was reassuring, in its way. It meant that I didn't have to wonder why Vice had not mentioned this. I was going to have to live with suspicion as my constant companion for the foreseeable future. I did not want it to develop into total paranoia.
"Can I ask why nothing has been done about Rosala, if its level of corruption is so high?"
"The enforcement of local laws is not the responsibility of the Adeptus Arbites," Stavak reminded me.
"Not even when it affects the planet's ability to meet its obligations to the Imperium? It is a question of balance and resources. Rosala is a large agri-sector."
It was. It took up half the landmass of a small continent in the southern hemisphere.
"Are you saying the problem is too big to deal with and should be ignored?"
"Not at all. Or perhaps not any longer, but Councillor Montfort and her allies have been careful. Other than the matter of Solas's export level, which is not information that it was possible for us to gather at this end, they've done nothing to interfere with this world's loyal service to the Imperium. And they have been the ones setting the laws of this world. There's been no way to intervene without destabilising the government."
"But the situation is different now," Stavark grinned.
"You are Lord Governor. Your word is the authority now."
I grinned back. "I believe we will be able to work together productively for the good of Solas."
"I hope so. You understand that what you're undertaking will cause upheavals."
"I've been sent to disrupt the corrupt order here. That is the command of the Adeptus Terror."
"Good.
So, based on what you know, is Councillor Trefect involved in the black market exportations from Rosala?"
"Involved? She controls it."
"Even better. What do you intend to do?" Stavark asked. "Make an example of her." I returned to Malvale that evening with a sense of having made real progress towards my goals, both official and personal. I retired to my chamber for a short while and wrote at the desk, filling in time before my evening meal with work, trying to keep myself distracted. It didn't work. My eyes kept going to the south window. I kept thinking about the roof of the tower. At length, I gave up. I left the chamber and climbed the ladder to the trap door. I paused before opening it. What do you expect to learn? Nothing. Though I hoped, against all reason, that I would learn something. What is this going to accomplish? Nothing. Even so, I pushed the door open and climbed onto the roof. It was a narrow circular space on the peak of the spire. The waist-high guardrail was a sour joke. I stared down. The ground seemed much further away than it did from the bedroom window. My head swam with vertigo. The cobblestones of Malvale's approach lured me with their mystery. Do you want to know how Eliana died? There's a sure way to learn. I blinked and shook off the spell. Get down from here. This is serving no purpose. I left the roof, telling myself that now I would be productive. But instead of returning to my desk, I headed for the ground floor. I was obeying an irrational impulse to go and stand where Eliana had fallen and look up to where she had stood for the last time. I was midway down the staircase to the ground floor when I heard a child laughing. I stopped, startled. I believed Karoff that none of the serfs brought their children with them to the house. At the same time, I was not imagining what I'd heard. I held my breath, listening intently, trying to hear past the immediately identifiable sounds of the ongoing cleaning and restoration of the house. The laugh came again, followed by another. There were two voices, somewhere on the ground floor, I thought. I hurried down the stairs, and the laughter pulled me deeper into the house, away from the long south-facing halls. I headed down corridors I'd not properly explored yet, following the echoes of mirth. The laughter was always just around the next corner, somewhere beyond the next room. The children must have been running. Though I was walking quickly, I was not catching up. And yet, I could not hear any footsteps. There was only the laughter, a mocking silvery bell that pulled me on. I was soon in a region of the house where the work of restoration had yet to begin. The doorways I passed opened onto chambers of cluttered, filled gloom. I took in vague impressions of huge, disordered masses, shouldering forward like stumbling hills. Every time I paused, the laughter would ring out again, and I would continue the pursuit. I asked myself if I was imagining the sound. The flashes of Clochtum that assailed me were so vivid, the memories of the trooper's screams were almost audible. But when Clochtum claimed me, I never heard the laughter of children. And this sound was clearly outside me. It bounced off the walls. As it moved around and I chased it, it grew more than less muffled. It wasn't in my mind. You better hope it isn't. If it was, I was losing the ability to distinguish fantasy and reality. I would truly be unfit. At last, the laughter led me into a lesser hall. It, too, had become a storage space. The discarded jumble of years was piled high in chaotic heaps. I could just manage to squeeze between the mounds of clutter, following a twisting path whose footing was treacherous with fallen objects. There was no organization here. Furniture, portraits, statues, candelabra and journals loomed over me. I passed chests of clothing, of footwear, of correspondence and of miscellaneous debris. It was like descending into an underground cavern, and the light from the torch sconces in the hall became very dim. I could barely see more than a foot in front of me. The path between the heaps was a vague greyness. The towering piles loomed heavily, as if ready to topple. The laughter had stopped when I entered the hall. Perhaps the children were hiding. Or perhaps they aren't there at all. I did not know which possibility was less disturbing. Then a familiar shape arrested my progress. It was half buried in the mound on my left, but there was so little light I could easily have missed it. It was an orrery of Solus's star system, made of crystal and bronze. My hand hovered over the shape of the planets thrusting out of the heap. I knew this piece because it had not belonged to Leonel. It was Eliana's, and it had been a fixture in our quarters together. I stared at it, half expecting its silhouette to dissolve into the shadows. I forgot about the laughter that had brought me here and tried to grasp the meaning of what I was seeing. It was easy enough to understand. It was harder to accept. I was used to the idea that Lionel had thrown more and more of his life into these rooms, rendering them unusable. But if this was our orrery, then Eliana had done the same. How long? For how long? The heap was quite far into the room. The orrery was nowhere near the top of the mound. What else from our life will I find here? Karoff saved me from learning more just then.
Lord Governor,
he called. I'm here, I said. The orrery remained solid. Speaking did not reveal it to be a hallucination. Karoff cleared his throat.
Your meal is ready, my lord.
Thank you. I'll be there in a moment. I stared at the orrery for a bit longer. I would have to come back here tomorrow, with more light, though I did not look forward to what I would discover. The laughter still had not returned. I turned to go, prepared to begin the hard process of accepting that my senses had deluded me. And then I saw them, in front and to my right, hidden in the shadows at the edge of a heap. They were so still, I'd gone right past them on my way into the far reaches of the hall.
Katrin? I whispered. Xander?
They stared at me, their eyes dark holes of night. They were the children I'd left behind, not the adult strangers I'd met these last 2 days. Their faces were pale, glowing milkily into the gloom. Their lips were parted in thin, solemn smiles. They were motionless as death. I gasped. My flesh prickled with shock. I stood as still as my children. Only they weren't my children. They weren't children at all. They were two porcelain statues, representations of children who had died, if they'd ever existed, generations ago. I took a step closer and saw, even in the dim light, the cracks in the white skin and the chips in the clothes. The boy was missing a hand, his left wrist ending in a hollow stump. I worked my way back to the corridor and lights as quickly as I could. Foolishness, I thought. All of this is foolishness. I'm tired. I need rest. That's all. And that's enough. I knew I was right. Yet I was relieved to see Karoff waiting for me in the doorway. And as we headed to the dining hall, it was an effort not to listen for the laughter. Chapter 5. Though the crowds were much smaller, there were still people in the square of the Emperor's Bounty when I reached the council hall for the next day's session. I vowed that today I would give them something to cheer. The session began with what was explained to me as the latest phase of an ongoing dispute between two minor agri-sectors, Genoa and Phryne. Neither was important enough to warrant representation on the inner council. The dispute had been winding its way back and forth along jurisdictional lines for over 50 years, and concerned three megafarms that were divided by the boundary as it now stood. Neither sector was claiming the farms in their entirety. In fact, in one instance, Phryne was insisting on giving Genoa the lion's share of one farm. It seemed the megafarms themselves were irrelevant. The dispute was an arcane mix of local laws, clannish feuds and traditions whose origins were lost to history, and so might as well have been eternal. As far as I could tell, the dispute was well on its way to becoming one of those traditions. The more the councillors explained it to me, the more I was inclined to let it carry on down its pointless path. I saw that its current purpose was to present me with an issue that was equal parts complex, trivial and stultifying. I grew angry as the session wore on. Xander made no attempt to hide his boredom and fell asleep in his throne. Vice said little, though we exchanged a knowing look. Montfort was quiet too. I felt her watching me. I let the explanations and debates continue until I was sure I had let enough time pass for my own preparations to be complete, so that what I needed would be waiting on the other side of the doors. Then I said, "Let me cut to the end. Do the parties to the dispute expect a ruling from me today?"
"They do not," said Amir Bakanta, councillor for the Grenfiers, the nearest large agri-sector to the antagonists. "An acknowledgement, I believe, of the gravity of the issue and a statement that it will be given the time and consideration warranted by its importance."
"Of that there is no doubt," I snapped. "I will sign a proclamation expressing those very words, now." I went on before Montfort could step in with the next deliberately pointless item on the agenda. "I want to return to a point of concern from our last meeting. Councillor Trefecht, what is the status of the investigation into black marketeering in Rosala?"
"Lord Governor, it has only been 2 days," she said, as if explaining the world to a child, "and the problem has only recently come to our attention. I'm afraid we will have to be patient."
"There is no virtue in having patience with corruption," I said. "I will not be patient." We would certainly act on what we do know, said Trefect. We could arrange for a demonstration of force.
That's an excellent idea, I said. Then, raising my voice, I called, Enforcer, you may proceed.
The doors to the inner council burst open, and Stavak entered, escorted by two troopers. Xander jerked awake, and Montfort actually looked startled.
Lord Governor, she began.
No, I said.
The troopers marched down the aisle towards Trefect. She rose confused, reaching for an authority that had suddenly deserted her.
Mariana Trefect, Stavart proclaimed. I arrest you for corruption and for crimes against the war effort of the Imperium.
That is ridiculous, she said.
You will have plenty of time to explain to us just how amusing you believe this to be, Stavak said.
The troopers put her in manacles and led her from the chamber. Stavak gave me a quick nod as he passed in front of me. We both had the same thought.
Now we have begun.
I called an end to the session. Then I stood and met the shouts of other councillors with silence. Of my foes, only Montfort was quiet. Her momentary break in composure was over. Her gaze went back and forth between me and her proxies. That was how I saw the other councillors now. They were not just her allies. They did not act without her consent. There was a weakness to their howling as one of their own was taken away. It was the screeching of the impotent. There was nothing they could do to stop what was happening, and it enraged them. But Montfort just watched. I'd seen the look on her face before. I'd seen it in my best officers, the ones who were the most lethal to the enemy as we developed our strategy of attack. Montfort withdrew without saying a word, and her exit was the signal for the others to abandon their protestations and follow. They stormed out. She glided through the doors, a grey shadow on a cane. Xander sat still through it all, his eyes wide. If I'd harboured any lingering doubts about his innocence, they would have been dispelled by his gaping, staggered incomprehension. I did not think he was so completely naive as to believe that there was no such thing as corruption. What I was seeing, I judged, was the result of his resolute disinterestedness. He had so utterly detached himself from any shred of responsibility that he could not grasp what he was seeing. Vice watched the end of the spectacle, then turned to face me, her expression doubtful. I left the council hall with her a few minutes later, after having given the others time to make their exits. If their departures looked like flights, so much the better.
You have more flair for the theatrical than I would have thought, Vice said as we approached the exit.
I learned its value on the battlefield, I told her. The enemy's perception can matter as much or more than reality.
So control their perception, Vice nodded.
That's something Montfort has been doing here for a long time. She is very, very good at it. I think I surprised her.
Maybe. That isn't the same as shaking her. Don't underestimate your opponent.
I don't think that's something I can ever do again. I suppressed a shudder as I involuntarily pictured the Tyranids.
You think I should have waited?
Until we could have had more evidence and more leverage ready, yes. Mason, you've only been here a few days.
I prefer to think I'm acting faster than she can be ready for me.
She's always ready. You showed your hand too soon. She will find a way to use what you did today against you. Outside, other than our two vehicles and their drivers, the square was deserted.
She already has, Vice whispered.
I looked around at the sudden emptiness.
Did everyone suddenly grow bored? I wondered.
This is Montfort's first countermove, said Vice. The people were hers. She told them to welcome you, and they welcomed you. She told them to vanish, and... She snapped her fingers.
Impressive, I said.
You're right. She is good at theatre.
That's just one reason why I've been urging caution. Did you not understand what I just said?
That these people were her creatures.
Not these people, the people. They aren't yours.
Maybe... If you'd been able to govern all these years, they might be. But this is how deep her grasp goes. This is how serious this war is.
Montfort and her circle have the claws embedded in every aspect of the life of Solus. They're all obscenely wealthy, but she's also made sure they're generous. This isn't just a few people at the top redirecting some shipments by issuing orders to ignorant lackeys.
I hope you don't think that's what I believe. Vice carried on as if I hadn't spoken.
The corruption is everywhere. It touches everything on Solus. The missing production doesn't all go off-world.
There are merchants who have more items than they should, and those items are easier to buy than they should be. I suppose that Montfort makes sure no one goes hungry during the drought years. Far fewer do than if the quota were being fulfilled. You and I know the necessity of sacrifice, but it is easily forgotten when someone has more to eat than they expected, and this is the result. She gestured at the empty square. You have the authority to rule. She has the means. Then I'll have to take those means away. I don't relish brutality, but I'll resort to it for the good of Solus and the Imperium. Vice sighed. I really hope you don't have to. So do I. How far do you think she dares to go? As far as it takes to defeat you and hold on to her place. I frowned, picturing worst-case scenarios. Does she have the militia's loyalty? My contacts there are limited. My impression is that to some extent, yes, she has. How deep or wide that loyalty is, I don't know, and that troubles me. I thought things through, then shook my head. It doesn't matter. There are limits to her power. An actual uprising would bring the Astra Militarum to Solus. She can't want that. It would destroy her completely. She doesn't need an uprising if she can rid herself of you. I hope she tries. I spoke with sudden violent feeling, surprising myself and shocking Vice. What have you been contemplating? She asked. I'm not sure. I took a few breaths, calming myself. But I had said what I had said and I meant it. Slowly, I saw why. Justice, perhaps. I don't understand. There was no reason for Eliana to be on the roof of that tower. No reason for her to go up. I went. It's just an invitation to an accident, and I only went there because she did. I doubt I would have even noticed the trapdoor otherwise. So, why go? Mason, Vice said gently. No, I won't accept that she jumped. I won't. Why would she have? That's not who she was. You think Montfort had her killed? Eliana dead. The children too young to rule. Me gone, perhaps forever. All of that must have made her ascension easier. Well, didn't it? It did, Vice admitted. But there's no evidence that she did. I have no love for her. If there's any way of toppling her, then let it be done. Still, you don't think she would have? It's far from possible. Even so, if she did it, let her try again. I was almost praying. She'll fail, and then she'll fall. Vice gave me a long look. Please promise me you won't do anything foolish. You've already provoked her enough. The screams of the dead of Clostrum roared through my head, and for a moment, all I asked for was one last reckless charge, one that would grant me the boon of oblivion and its silence at the end. The moment passed. I thought of Katrin and Xander. I thought of what I was trying to build on Solus. I was here for more than destruction. Oblivion was not mine to claim, and I would not reward Veth Montour's arrogance. I would not give her the victory she believed was hers to claim. I promise, I said. Vice looked me in the eyes a few seconds longer. All right, she said. Good. She got into her car. It was starting to rain again. That night, I focused on my breathing once again, trying to hear that and not the memories. My instinct was to squeeze my hands against my ears. I forced myself to hold my arms at my sides. The voices are inside your head, not outside. Face them down. Breathe, breathe, breathe. Some of the voices, the ones I could barely make out, truly did seem to be coming from outside my memory. In my imagination, they were floating through the house, calling at the entrance of each room. They're going to get louder, closer, sooner or later they'll find you. Stop it! Stop it! The fear the memories were stirring was real. The pain they were causing was real. The voices were not. They were no more real here than they had been in my quarters on the Eternal Fury. The children's voices, whispering now between the laughs, kept growing closer. They were louder now than the screams of my soldiers, louder than the snarls of the Tyranids. The giggling climbed the steps of my tower. In a moment, it would be outside my door. I held my breath, waiting for the scratch of fingernails. I was straining with all my being to listen, trying to hear what I did not want to hear. I was rigid on my bed, paralyzed as I waited for the impossible to happen. It's haunted. The memory of Katrin's voice, quiet and fearful. I had to let the breath go, and I realized I was listening to silence. There were no voices. I gasped for air. The only sound was my breathing. There was no laughter. There never had been. I could move again. The howls of the memories had receded. I was back in the quiet. The tension gradually flowed out of my body, as if the rigidity had turned to water and was slowly leaking from me, into the bed, to the floor, and down through the house to the ground below. I took deep, grateful breaths. I thought I would sleep. I actually welcomed the prospect of sleep. In my last moment of consciousness, the sound came, clear and beautiful as a chime. Eliana called to me, "Mason!" There was a spasm of grief. I was leaving her in the waking night as I fell into the dream world. Then she came with me. At first I saw her in a cascade of memories. I was dancing with her again on the night we first met, at a ball for the nobility thrown by Lionel in the council hall, at a time when he still left Melvale. I saw her striding from the Administratum Palace, where she reigned over an entire division, her walk as she descended the steps, pure and purposeful, the simple movement of a leg locking itself forever into my heart. I saw her holding our infant daughter. I saw her comforting our son when he'd fallen as a toddler. I saw our lovemaking. Each memory was perfectly defined, as clear as if I were experiencing present moments. But I knew they were the past. I felt the moments as I had when they occurred, and I felt them through the filter of loss. I mourned anew, seeing so clearly what I had once had, and never would again. My dream self-sobbed. "Mason." The images came quickly, nearly simultaneously. A flickering gallery of joys turned into pain. Through them I kept hearing her voice. "Mason." She was there before me. Not a memory now, though we were standing in the entrance hall of our apartments in Valgast. I was myself, as I was, in the present. I had aged. I was faintly aware of the background hum of my prosthesis servo motors. Eliana was as I had last seen her. The sharp eyes that saw through me and loved me all the same, that understood what I meant even when I was speaking like a fool. The smile that mocked, without truly mocking, that invited me into the shared joke between us. "Mason," she said again. "What are you staring at?" "You," I said, my voice a breaking croak, riven by joy and grief to be speaking with her again. "I don't know that dress." "It's my nightdress," she said. "It was new. You never saw this one. It's the one I died in." I tried to answer. I could only groan. "It's all right," she said gently. "Everything is all right." So often I had wished for just one more conversation, a wish to say goodbye, to say at least one of the things that was so important and that I'd never had the chance to say. "I'm sorry I wasn't here," I said. Her smile became melancholy. "There's nothing to forgive. You couldn't be here. I miss you so much." "Shh," she said. "There, there. There, there." She raised a finger and stroked my cheek. I felt her touch. I jerked awake with a gasp, the touch lingering on my skin, hot and cold at the same time. Then I saw that I was still in the dream. Though I was in my bedchamber in Malvale, Eliana was there too, standing in the doorway. "Come with me," she said, holding out her hand. I climbed out of the bed. Everything seemed real. I felt the brushing of the sheets against my legs and the cold